Hey y'all, I'm Carrie.
I'm Mama.
And this is Monster. This episode contains topics and language that may not be suitable for all listeners, and topics that may be triggering to some. Listener discretion is advised. Right. So, as everyone heard, Mandy's not back yet. We don't know when she'll be back full time, but we are working to figure it out so that way she'll be here when she can. She's still out of state dealing with all of that.
Mess.
So, being out of state, everything she has going on, it's hard. So, sometimes she'll be here, sometimes she won't be. As everyone knows, family tragedy is hard. It's not easy trying to, you know, deal with grief and navigate all that comes with being the executor of things, all of that. So she'll be back with us momentarily.
We wish her best and hopefully everything will straighten itself out.
Right. So we know that as a listener, it can be frustrating whenever a host is gone or episodes are late, things like that. We apologize for that. And we appreciate everyone, you know, understanding and being supportive through all of that, because it's a lot and it hasn't been easy on Mandy or her family. So we appreciate all of that. So now we're going to get into it.
Where are we going today?
We have a 2-in-1 today. It is a mystery, which we all love. And it is also an aspect that I love. Mandy hates it. We'll see how you feel. Along with being a mystery, it's also an unsolved true crime case.
Ooh.
Yep.
I like those.
So I'm going to tell you about the Yuba County Five. So only months before the nation had reeled from the unimaginable tragedy of the Hartford Circus Fire, chaos, confusion, and overwhelming loss all brought to a devastating conclusion beneath a burning tent. But in the quiet, isolated corners of America, other kinds of tragedies were unfolding. Stories whispered, mysteries unsolved, where the lack of answers chills even more than any fire. Our story tonight is one of those. There's no flames, no noise. Just five men and the silence that swallowed them whole. February 24th, 1978, Gridley, California, a small agricultural town where life moved at a steady, predictable pace. For five friends, this Friday night held the promise of simple enjoyment, a college basketball game. There was Jack Adruga, 30 years old. He was a quiet man who owned the green 1969 Mercury Montego.
Nice car.
Then there was Bill Sterling, who was 29, and Jackie Hewitt, 24, who were both said to be gentle souls. Ted Wire, 32, was friendly and outgoing. Four of these men managed varying degrees of developmental or intellectual disabilities, but they were largely independent and found camaraderie in each other. And finally, Gary Mathis, who was 25, was a Vietnam vet whose struggles with paranoid schizophrenia were known, and he was the fifth and final man. He was still very much a part of this tight-knit group, despite his mental illnesses and the struggles that he faced.
A lot of that was probably PTSD.
Oh, yeah. I have no doubt in that. Yeah. But back then,
yeah,
diagnoses were not all that accurate.
No. Today, most diagnoses ain't all that accurate.
Right. So these five men called themselves the Boys. Every Friday, they gathered together for basketball games, car rides, and late night snacks, a ritual that gave them structure and joy. For a group that sometimes felt out of step with the world, these simple traditions were everything. It wasn't just friendship. It was a family. The five friends weren't just close. They depended on each other in ways that went deeper than a basic friendship. Four of them lived with, like I said, varying degrees of developmental disabilities, but they were functional, kind, and capable. Together, they made sense of a world that didn't always make sense back.
Ain't that the truth?
Right. Their routines gave them structure. The basketball games, car rides, familiar roads. They thrived in what was predictable. And that Friday night was supposed to be exactly that. Predictable. They'd spend hours talking about basketball stats and laughing over inside jokes only they understood. They had planned that spring a softball league, maybe even a road trip to LA to see a real NBA game. They were men with routines, dreams, and a shared love of simple joys. So that Friday night, they joked about snacks and whether Chico could beat their hometown team. Someone forgot their lucky radio. Someone else swore they'd stop for burgers on the way back. It was a night that should have ended with laughter and a drive home under the stars, not in silence. So they were headed to a game at Chico State, which was about 50 miles away. A simple plan they'd executed many times before. They were last seen at roughly 8:30 p.m. at a market in Oroville where they bought snacks and drinks. The road ahead was clear. The night was young. But somehow, between that brightly lit store and the gymnasium of Chico, their path veered catastrophically off course.
Damn.
Saturday morning brought the first whispers of alarm. The men didn't come home. Days of fruitless searching passed along the main highways. The weather, initially mild, quickly turned to a deep, biting cold in the upper elevations, adding a sinister urgency to the search. So the search began on those main roads, a routine process that yielded nothing. But 5 days later, the focus shifted entirely. Then, on Wednesday, March 1st, 5 days after they vanished, a breakthrough came, but one that only deepened the confusion. A Forest Service worker checking remote roads in the Plumas National Forest came upon the mercury. The car was stuck in snow and mud, roughly 60 miles in the wrong direction from their intended route. High on a winding logging road near Kimshu Lookout.
Dang.
Yep. So they ended up 60 miles in the complete opposite direction of where they were supposed to be going. On a logging road, no less.
Somebody took a wrong turn.
So this detour was baffling. It took them past their destination, past the town of Oroville, and deep into the trenches of unpaved wilderness far above the snow line.
That don't make sense.
They traveled well past a road closed area as well.
Somebody didn't want that car to be found.
Mm-hmm. So when the ranger first saw the car, he thought it might have been left by hunters or hikers. But as he wiped the frost from the windshield and saw the snack wrappers inside, candy bars, empty soda cans, something about it felt wrong. Too ordinary and too recent. So the car was discovered nearly 20 miles from the nearest sign of civilization. Yeah. So for 20 miles, there was
no nothing.
No people, nothing but forest. This wasn't just a wrong turn. It was a deliberate detour into nowhere. And the ranger that found the car said that it felt like finding a ghost. A car that was too clean, too still, sitting in the kind of silence that makes you whisper without knowing why. The ranger also said the air was so still, it felt like the mountain itself was holding its breath. No footprints, no sound, just the car, like a question left behind in the snow. The car was not disabled. The engine was functional and it had half a tank of gas, which would have been enough to get them out. They had tried to push it, judging by the marks that were left, but then just stopped. The driver's side window was down as if they'd been talking to someone.
The bumble got him.
Sorry, guys. We were talking about Rudolph earlier today. So inside the car, investigators found wallets with money, their keys, and uneaten snacks.
See, now there's something wrong with that because men don't leave uneaten snacks.
But so it wasn't robbery because there's
money and keys.
Right.
Car alone is worth it. Well, now it's worth some money, but.
Right. So the police noted that this was not the action of men who had panicked. It was the deliberate action of men who left on foot, possibly expecting to return later. They had abandoned a functioning car and their personal effects in freezing conditions, walking away from full safety. Investigators were flustered.
To say the least.
They were perplexed. Why walk? The road ahead was too snowed in to drive, but turning around was possible. So why wouldn't they just turn around?
Makes sense to me.
The functional mercury could have served as a shelter, keeping them warm for hours.
Yeah, even because if you let it idle, the engine running with the window rolled down, they at least stayed warm.
Right. Even if they couldn't have turned around and gotten out, it still would have at least kept them warm until someone found them.
Yeah.
Yet, they had tried to push the heavy vehicle, exhausting themselves up the road, and then just simply stopped, stepping out into the lethal cold. This wasn't a snap decision. It was a deliberate choice to walk away from their keys, their wallets, and their best chance at survival.
I don't think they walked away on of their own volition.
Well, that's part of the mystery.
Dan, I said another fancy word.
So by now, five families were trapped in a nightmare without edges. No footprints, no blood, no sign of struggle. Just a single car sitting in the snow like a tombstone. Every night, the searchlights cut through the fog, and every morning, they came back empty-handed. It was as if the mountain had swallowed them whole, quietly, deliberately, without leaving a trace. So the car itself told a bizarre story of confusion and deliberate retreat. But it was the account of one man that suggested the retreat was born from fear. The mountain was brutal that time of year. Snow piled in thick, shifting drifts, swallowing whole roads overnight. Searchers described the silence as suffocating. No bird, no winds, only the soft hiss of falling snow and the groan of trees bending under its weight. I didn't think, sorry, not to, you know, stop mid-sentence, but I didn't think it snowed like that in California.
It does up in the northern part, honey.
Does it really?
And it snows in the mountains.
See, when I lived in California, one, I was little, but two, it was during the summertime, so.
And it was also Southern California. It don't snow down there.
Oh, what, is this Northern California?
Yes.
Oh.
Sorry, guys, I lived in California for 20 years.
That's why I'm asking you, because I'm like, I didn't think it snowed like
that. Yeah, it does in the northern part, honey.
Look at that. Learned something new. Okay.
Where'd you say this was? Or
Yuba County.
Yuba County. Hold
on. Yeah, that's what they're called.
Y-U-B-A. Yuba. I'm trying to
see. It's one of California's biggest unsolved mysteries.
Yeah, see, it's up by Sacramento. And Sacramento's at the northern part of the state. That's what I was looking up.
I was really little when we lived in California, so I don't really know where anything is.
I wasn't sure. That's why I had to pull it up.
Oh, I know you and Aunt Debbie were the ones to. Okay. Anyway. So it said that this was a place that punished hesitation, where one wrong turn could erase you completely.
You fall off the side of a mountain, and we're talking the Sierra Nevadas, and them, they're higher than, if I'm not mistaken, they're higher, which I could be. I'm not the smartest crayon in the box. I think they're higher than the Appalachians.
Really?
Yeah.
Because the Appalachians are huge.
Well, so is the Sierra Nevada, honey.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
See, I don't really know a whole lot about California. North Carolina and the Appalachians. Got you covered. That's where I grew up, though. So,
yeah.
In school, you know, you learn about all that.
Oh, yeah.
Out there. I didn't realize there were that many parts of California that were uninhabited like that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It gets too damn cold in those Sierra Nevadas.
Huh.
You think it gets cold here? We're talking wind chills of negative 100.
We get into the
wind chills, negative 100.
Yeah, we get that here too. We haven't since you've come out here, but we have.
Not a negative 100.
Yeah. A couple years ago, we got nothing but ice. We didn't get snow. We got ice.
I got news for you. It gets like negative 100. My butt ain't coming out from underneath that electric blanket.
Oh, yeah, I know.
Unless it's the potty.
Yeah, I think it was the year before you came out here or 2 years before you came out here. There were a couple of days I didn't go to work because it was just way too fucking cold.
The boys did not go to school either?
They canceled school the night before because for
so
two
cold.
Days in a row because the wind chill was so cold that you walk outside
It just takes your breath away.
Well, not just that. You were at risk of hypothermia just by walking outside.
No, thank you.
Right. So it gets that cold.
You're making me cold just talking about it.
Okay. Sorry. Anyway. Okay. So the time of abandonment was near roughly 11:30 p.m. on Friday. Obviously, that's speculative. They got that based off of...
They're going to the store and...
Right. But we don't really know 100%.
And they didn't have cell phones back then.
Right. So this placed them in a region where the temperature hovered just below freezing. So just below
32 degrees.
Yep. This was manageable for several hours with proper clothing. However, by the time the car was discovered on Wednesday, a thick sheet of snow and ice had locked the area down with temperatures plummeting. So the initial choice to walk away, while illogical, was only lethal because of the rapid, severe change in the environment that then followed.
Yeah, because you can get warm up clothes on, you'll freeze to death in a matter of hours.
Oh, yeah. So adding to that confusion was the unverified testimony of Joseph Schroons, a local resident, claimed that he had been on that same road late Friday night. Suffering from chest pains, what he had feared was a heart attack, he saw the mercury and five men nearby. Schwinn's desperately pleaded with them for assistance, but according to his account, the men were agitated. One that matched the description of Gary Mathis was shining a flashlight erratically, seeming to illuminate the area, not the road itself. When Schwinn's cried out for help, one of the five men called out that they didn't need any help. So if true, they were alive together and lucid enough to refuse a chance at rescue around 11:30 p.m. that night. They deliberately rejected the only apparent chance of survival, a fact that defies all logic. Schwinn's story, though disputed, painted a picture of panic. He remembered the group being oddly defensive. He saw the flashlight beam and not aimed at the road to help him, but sweeping the tree line as if they were actively searching or hiding from something that was lurking in the dark. Their refusal of help was direct. They weren't lost. They were busy. If Schwinn's account is true, it means that at the moment of their vanishing, these men were not victims of confusion. They were in a state of active, intentional withdrawal from the outside world. Investigators widely dispute the reliability of Schwinn's account, though, noting inconsistencies in his story. The immediate massive search was fruitless. A heavy snow fell after, acting as a perfect silent eraser, wiping away any of the five men's tracks.
Yeah.
So they can't even figure out where they went because of the snow that came. Yeah. Humans aren't built for that kind of silence. After hours of cold, hunger, and confusion, the mind begins to twist in on itself.
Yeah, it does.
You start to see things that aren't there, hear voices that don't exist, and in the dark, more than anywhere, every sound becomes a threat and every shadow becomes a reason to run. The weeks passed, snow fell, and hope thinned. The search teams kept coming back with the same three words, nothing new found. For the families, time froze right alongside the mountain. They kept setting the table for five, kept checking the driveway at night. Some left the porch lights burning for years. It wasn't grief that lived with them. It was limbo. Years later, some of their parents still kept the same phone numbers listed in the directory just in case one of the boys ever called home. Hope doesn't fade on a schedule. It just grows quieter. But the mountain never forgets what it swallows. 4 long months after they vanished, the spring thaw finally began to reveal the grim, impossible truth. The intense initial search, defeated by the weather, saw the case go cold until the early summer thaw in June of 1978, when the mountain began to surrender its grim evidence.
Dang, I was only 17.
Oh, yeah, I guess you were, huh? I wasn't even thought of yet.
Neither was your mama.
So the discovery of the bodies didn't bring any peace. It only deepened the horror and mystery. Every clue felt like it should lead to an answer, but each one led to another dead end. It was as if the mountain had designed the mystery itself, giving just enough to torment, but never enough to explain. On June 4th, a group of motorcyclist discovered a small, isolated U.S. Forest Service trailer, roughly 19 miles from the spot where the Mercury had been abandoned. The lock had been broken off the door and tossed aside, a clear sign of forced entry. Inside was the body of Ted, who early reports had misidentified as Jack Hewitt, but it was Ted unmistakably. Crucially, the interior of the trailer showed no evidence of a struggle, forced restraint, or blood, complicating any theory of violence.
But he just freed to death?
So the trailer was fully equipped. It contained a working propane tank for heat, dry blankets, and a stack of emergency C rations.
I'd have been turning that propane on, wrapping up in all the blankets, and eating something.
You would think anybody would.
I'm a fat girl. I'm going to eat.
They had broken in and stayed for a time. Some clothing was found neatly folded inside, suggesting a period of calm and rational thought. But the most shocking paradox was the untouched food. They had broken into Salvation, yet the vast majority of the sea rations remained stacked and sealed. The trailer was a literal sanctuary. Inside, investigators found dozens of neatly stacked cans of pork and beans, chili, and military-grade biscuits. All they had to do was open the cans, but they didn't. They starved.
Yeah, because military men should have known how to open those.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that strange?
Kind of odd.
Right. So this is the single, unsolvable horror of the Yuba County Five. The men died of starvation next to a full pantry and a working propane heater.
Now, all the men were in there?
That's where they found Ted, was inside the trailer. Isn't that strange?
Yeah, but like you said, they were mentally challenged.
Right.
So they may not have thought that, though.
Maybe not, but you would think if you're starving and there's a full pantry, even if it's not yours.
I'm going to eat. I'm going to eat.
Back later.
Yeah.
You would think.
An IOU.
Right, you would think anyway.
But with them mentally...
And then who knows how long it took them to get there as well. Who knows? That's the mystery part of this. Everybody
can assume what they want.
Right. It's like, what happened? Why didn't you eat the food that was right
next to you? There's probably several theories.
Oh, yeah. So investigators noted that only a small, desperate amount of food had been consumed. So they ate some of it, but not enough to survive. Some melted rations and portions of canned food had been ate. A jar of petroleum jelly was also found among those items.
I don't want to know.
Nobody knows.
I don't want to know.
Nobody knows.
Because I know where my mind's going.
Nobody knows what the significance of that is. It's just something that's, in everything that I've seen, it was noted that it was there among all of that, but nobody knows why. The consensus among the officers who processed the scene was that this was the most inexplicable situation that they had ever encountered. And I'm sorry, this is the most weirdest case that I've seen.
Weird's not the word for it.
The following days brought more gruesome discovery. Jack Madruga's remains were found just a few hundred yards from the trailer. Bill Sterling's remains were located roughly 11 miles from the original abandoned car and were found without his dentures. Jack Hewitt's remains, the fourth victim, were also recovered within that same vicinity.
That's wild.
Right?
Did they split up or?
Well, I wouldn't think that it would be that they split up because they were all found in the same vicinity. I wonder if they slowly started to kind of die off. That sounds awful to say it that way. I'm sorry. As they made their way, but it was only miles from where the car was found. Yeah, it's so strange. So the autopsies of the four recovered men, because there's only four found so far, were officially cited as hypothermia and starvation as the causes of death.
And the hypothermia will kill him in no time.
Oh, yeah. So Ted, the main fan on the trailer, was estimated to have survived for a minimum of 8 weeks.
And he didn't eat nothing? Or turn on their propane? What the hell's wrong with these people?
Isn't it strange?
They on some good drugs.
Some reports suggested that he survived up to 13 weeks inside the shelter before he succumbed to the elements and everything. Isn't that so strange?
That is weird.
And even during the day, never went for help, nothing. So strange.
Because you figure something like that, you'd automatically go into fight or flight
right.
mode.
Like at night, I get
looking not going
shelter,
out,
but during the day,
I'd be hoofing it.
Right.
Get me the heck out
this
of there.
Is the weirdest case I've ever seen in my life so far. So this confirmed that he had died slowly over days or even months. Inside or immediately next to salvation.
Poor guy. That's an awful way to go.
Odd. So, Ted, at the time of his disappearance, he weighed approximately 200 pounds. They found him. He had lost nearly 100 pounds.
Because his body was eating his own fat.
Right, because he wasn't eating anything. Yeah.
What a way to go. Oh.
He had endured a slow, desperate, and agonizing decline that lasted for weeks, a haunting final chapter to the life of a very gentle soul. This wasn't a sudden disaster. It was a prolonged tragedy of incomprehensible choices made over 2 months, with the shelter they broke into offering no relief from the hunger that ultimately claimed them. Furthermore, the condition of the bodies presented even more confusion, because, you know, we don't have enough of that already. So crucially, Ted was found wrapped in blankets with his feet severely frostbitten, but his heavy boots were missing.
That don't sound right.
Yeah, they were just gone. Next to him on the floor was a pair of tennis shoes identified as belonging to Gary Mathis.
Did Gary have his boots?
So this single piece of evidence suggests that Gary was the last man with Ted, that he tended to him and then exchanged his thin shoes for Ted's boots before heading back into the wild alone. Which, that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, if Ted's gone, I'm going to take his shoes too. I'm sorry.
Right. Sounds awful, but...
But it's fight or flight.
Right. So this final rational act complicates every single theory, suggesting a moment of clear thought amid the crisis. The overall pattern of discarded shoes, thin, mismatched footwear, and Ted's frostbite is consistent with paradoxical undressing or terminal burrowing, where victims of severe hypothermia become so disoriented that they strip off vital clothing or seek enclosed spaces moments before death, further pointing to a complete collapse of rational thought. Because when you have hypothermia, your body
shuts down.
Your brain makes you think you're hot. So then you start ripping your clothes off because you're hot, but you're not actually hot. You're freezing.
And your body's shutting down.
Right. And a lot of hypothermia patients do that. A lot of people that die of hypothermia are found naked or near naked, missing vital clothes that are needed to keep them warm, things like
that. That's a scary sight.
So furthermore, Ted's gold watch and signet ring were found neatly placed on the dashboard of the Mercury, suggesting a strange final decision to leave behind all personal values before entering the wilderness.
But you figured they'd take it with them so they could identify themselves.
You would think,
They could be identified.
Yeah, you would think so.
Well, that don't make no sense.
So the ultimate question was the fate of the one missing man, Gary Mathis. Because they've only found 4 of the 5. His body was never found.
Some animal ate his ass.
His absence only compounded the terrible unanswered questions surrounding their final hours. 4 men had been recovered, and the veteran was lost to the mountain forever. Isn't that so strange?
He's alive, so he's alive living in Vegas.
Probably not now.
Well, yeah. He was how old?
He's in his 30s.
Okay, that was, he would only be in his late 70s.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Anyway, so 3 main theories emerged, each more unsettling than the last. First, psychosis and misdirection. Mm-hmm. Then an external threat, And finally, the simplest and perhaps the coolest, environmental disorientation. So when logic fails, we reach for stories. We start weaving explanations to fill in the silence. Because silence, especially this kind, doesn't feel natural. It feels intentional. So the first theory focuses on, like I said, psychosis and misdirection, centering around Gary Mathis. As a Vietnam veteran struggling with paranoid schizophrenia, the extreme stress of being stranded in the cold could have triggered a major episode.
Yeah.
Mathis was the most capable of the group, and they trusted him inexplicably. If he became convinced that the car was bugged, or that food in the cabin was poisoned, or that an external group was chasing them, they would follow his lead. This one tragic possibility, a final fatal betrayal of one man's mind, is the only factor that logically explains the refusal of eating the food, the bizarre organized state of the trailer, and Gary's final unexplained disappearance. So, the fact that they would follow him because they trusted him, they would have acted accordingly based off whatever belief it was that he had in that moment. They would have chose starvation over an imagined danger just because he said it.
Yeah.
And the evidence inside the trailer supports this. Calm organization, food untouched, and Gary's shoes left behind in a final clue.
I think they were all there in the shelter up until the dude died.
Yeah. And then they just kind of
spread out.
Yeah. So the fact that Gary remains missing should suggest his acute condition may have led him the furthest from the shelter. This theory remains highly speculative, though. We know Gary had been involuntarily committed several times, and his specific delusion often involved a fear of police or government agents, which could explain the group's frantic attempt to hide or flee.
Yeah, now I can see that.
But why has he never been found?
I think he froze to death out in the mountains.
You know what I mean? Like, the other four were found.
Yeah, but the further you get in those mountains, the harder it's going to be.
Right, but I mean, like, so they knew the vicinity that they were in.
Yeah,
right?
But who knows how far he got?
So you start there and then move out.
Yeah, but who knows how far he got? He could have got 20 miles from there being a military man, honey.
Yeah, they're but subject- with no food, you know what I mean? In the
we don't know if he took rations with him or not, though.
I don't know. It's just, it's so strange. It's so strange. Okay, so now we move into the second theory, which is an external threat. The refusal to accept help from Joseph Schwoons, if you believe his story, is the key piece of evidence here, suggesting that the men were actively hiding from something or someone. This could have been an encounter with drug dealers, criminal group, an isolated hostile individual, anything. If a sixth man or another group was involved, they might have forced the five off the road. The broken lock on the trailer and the men's subsequent failure to utilize the food could be consistent with being briefly imprisoned or actively fleeing a nearby threat. However, the fact that the recovered body showed no signs of struggle or violence strongly weighs against this theory, suggesting their fate was internal rather than in a confrontation.
Yeah, I believe that.
Yeah. So it makes sense, but there's really no evidence to really prove it.
Well, and the cold would have preserved
any evidence.
Any evidence. Yeah. And there wasn't any.
Right. At least not that they found then, anyway.
Yeah. But if they found him with the thaw, that evidence wouldn't have been gone long.
No. No.
And if they were shot or stabbed, that would definitely show it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So our third explanation is a tragic combination of environmental disorientation and hypothermia.
That's more than likely.
Probably. So the cold alone could have severely impaired the men's judgment even before they reached the mountain.
Yeah.
The initial panic of being stuck led to an irrational decision to abandon the functioning car. Once hypothermia set in, their ability to reason collapsed entirely, a state often described as being snow drunk.
I never heard that before.
It's kind of like snow blindness. The light reflects off the snow so bad where you can't see.
Yeah, it's like the rain on the wet roads from the rain.
Right.
Throws you a glare.
Right. So it's just like that. You're stuck in the snow and your brain starts to freak out, basically, and act
stupid
as if you're drunk when you're actually not. So they would not have registered the food in the trailer as a means of survival, nor the cold as a threat. Just like when you're drunk.
I'm fine.
Right, exactly. Their final illogical decisions, which was to discard their clothes, to wander, and to ignore the stacked cans, were the direct deadly effects of freezing to death, the hypothermia. And many investigators view this as the most plausible explanation.
More than that, it's the one that makes the most sense to me.
Yeah, it makes more sense. But it's just crazy, the whole thing. It's insane.
And Gary's body's probably buried.
Yeah, it's never been. He's never been.
He could have been down, fallen down ravine, a deep ravine, and they could, you know,
right,
never see it.
Animals and yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's bears up there and coyotes and cougars and all that fun stuff. Mm-hmm.
So the case of the Yuba County Five remains officially unsolved. No definitive evidence exists to reconcile the logical facts, which is the car, the stack.
I don't think it was foul play. I really don't.
There's no evidence of it. But they can't close it until they know what happened.
Yeah, that's true. And or they find Gary's body, which I don't think they ever will. I think he fell down a ravine. And because there's a lot of, up in that area, there's a lot of caves that are hidden, you know, and he could have went into one of those and died.
Yeah.
That's like hidden behind trees and brush. Mm-hmm. And
okay, so no evidence exists to reconcile the logical facts with the deeply illogical outcome. For the families, the lack of definitive answers has prolonged the grief for decades. They are left not just with the pain of loss, but with the eternal torment of why. They are forced to debate whether the loved one suffered a betrayal by a stranger, a slow physical descent, or a final cruel betrayal of their own minds. This silence, this complete lack of closure, is the mountain's final, harshest sentence. The mountains still hold the final, unknowable truth of why the five lost boys of Yuba County simply starved next to their salvation. The search for logic ended decades ago. What's left are stories, the kind that live longer than the people who tell them. Even now, hikers and hunters in the Plumas National Forest talk about the Yuba County Five. They say the story clings to that mountain like fog. Some claim to hear voices calling names through the snow. Others say they've seen a faint green light flickering near the car where the car was found, as if the mountain still remembers. These accounts are folklore and not part of the official investigation, obviously. And if you ever find yourself driving through the Sierra foothills on a winter night, keep an eye out on the tree line. Locals say that you can still see five shadows moving through the snow searching for the road home. In the years that have followed, new sheriffs have come and went, each reopening the files, hoping to see something that the others had missed. But the evidence never changes, and neither does the silence. This case remains one of California's coldest, a reminder that not every mystery is meant to be solved. Some monsters have claws or knives. Others are made of isolation, darkness, and fear. That whispers that logic will save you right up until it doesn't. The Yuba County Five remind us that sometimes the monster is the moment you step off the map. Maybe the real tragedy isn't that they got lost, but that something in that silence made them stay lost. Like the mountain didn't just trap them, it convinced them to stop fighting. And the only witness to what truly happened that night remains the cold, silent mountain itself.
And the good Lord above.
Right. And maybe somewhere beneath that snow, the wind still carries their names, whispered to anyone willing to listen. And that is our story on the Yuba County Five.
That's wild.
Isn't that just...
It blows your mind because your mind's going in like five different directions. That's... You know, it's like...
Right, like, it's all logical, but then it's like, but no, why would you make that
No, a lot of, some of it didn't make sense.
Well, I mean, like, the theories. The theories are logical. They make sense. But then again, it's like, but why? It makes sense to break into the trailer, right? You're in the freezing cold. That's a smart decision.
Yes.
But why not eat the food?
Exactly.
Why not then leave the trailer if you're...
Stay there, turn on the propane heater, and wait for morning to get help.
Right. And that's what I mean. Like, there's a lot of logical things, but the choices were illogical.
Yeah.
So it's like, what was happening that made you not make that logical choice to survive? It is just, it is so strange.
Makes no sense to me, baby.
No. I thought it was a good one.
That was a good one. Nice change of pace.
Right. Now, next week, it's Thanksgiving.
Yummy, yummy.
Mm-hmm. So next week we have a Thanksgiving episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So this one was a good buffer between last week and next week. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's all I got. So thank you for joining us for this tragic and endearing unsolved mystery. If the story stayed with you, please take a moment to rate and review. You can find our links to our Facebook community as well as our email in the description, like normal. Make sure you come back on Monday, like I said, when the holiday season turns deadly. We'll be traveling to a quiet suburban home, exploring the scene where a family feast became a horrifying bloodbath.
Nice.
It was a day meant for gratitude and togetherness, but instead it became a national nightmare. Mm-hmm. Until then, stay safe, try not to stray too far off the main road, and as always, remember to
watch out for monsters
and don't kill people. Bye, y'all.
Bye, y'all.